It's like you stepped out of a storybook. I gestured. Gracious, flattering, understated, affectionate acceptance. Vachette reached out and flicked my ear hard with a finger. Ow! I burst out laughing. Fine! But don't you dare accuse me of melodrama. You people are one great unending dramatic gesture. The quiet, the blood-red clothes, the hidden language, secrets and mysteries. It's like your lives are one giant dumb show. I met her eye. And I do mean that in all its various clever implications. Well, you impressed Cheyenne, she said, which is the most important thing. And you did it in such a way that the heads of the other schools won't be able to grumble too much, which is the other most important thing. We reached our destination, a low building of three rooms next to a small split-timber goat pen. Here is the one who will tend to your hand, she said. What of the apothecary? I asked. The apothecary is close friends with Carceret's mother, Vachette said, and I would not have her looking after your hands for a weight of gold. She nodded her head at the nearby house. Dalen, on the other hand, is who I would come to if I needed mending. She knocked on the door. You may be a member of the school, but do not forget that I am still your teacher. In all things, I know what is best. Later, my hand tightly bandaged, Vachette and I sat with Cheyenne. We were in a room I'd never seen before, smaller than the rooms where we had discussed the Lathani. There was a small, messy writing desk, some flowers in a vase, and several comfortably cushioned chairs. Along one wall was a picture of three birds in flight against a sunset sky, not painted, but composed of thousands of pieces of bright enameled tile. I suspected we might be in the equivalent of Cheyenne's study. How is your hand? Cheyenne said. Fine, I said. It is a shallow cut. Dalen has the smallest stitches I have ever seen. He is quite remarkable. She nodded. Approval. I held up my left hand, wrapped in clean white linen. The hard part will be keeping this hand idle for 4 days. I already feel as if it were my tongue that were cut, and not my hand. Cheyenne gave a slight smile at this, startling me. The familiarity of the expression was a great compliment. You performed quite well today. Everyone is speaking of it. I expect a few that saw have better things to speak about, I said modestly. Amused disbelief. That may be true, but those who watched from hiding will doubtless say what they have seen. Celian herself will have already told 100 people unless I miss my guess. By tomorrow, everyone will expect your stride to shake the ground as if you were Aeth himself come back to visit us. I couldn't think of anything to say, so I kept quiet. A rarity for me. But as I've said, I had been learning. There is something I have been waiting to speak to you about, Cheyenne said, guarded curiosity. After Tempi brought you here, he told me the long story of your time together, she said, of your search for the bandits. I nodded. Is it true that you made blood magic to destroy some men, then called lightning to destroy the rest? Vachette looked up at this, glancing back and forth between us. I had grown so used to speaking Aeturan with her that it was odd to see the expressionless Adam impassivity covering her face. Still, I could tell she was surprised. She hadn't known. I thought of trying to offer an explanation for my actions, then decided against it. Yes. You are powerful, then. I had never thought of it in those terms before. I have some power. Others are more powerful. Is that why you seek the K-10? To gain power? No. I seek from curiosity. I seek the knowing of things. Knowing is a type of power, Cheyenne pointed out, then seemed to change the subject. Tempi told me there was a Rinta among the bandits as their leader. Rinta? I asked respectfully. A bad thing. A man who is more than a man, yet less than a man.
A demon? I asked, using the Aeturan word without thinking.
Not a demon, Shayn said, switching easily to Aeturan. There are no such things as demons. Your priests tell stories of demons to frighten you.
She met my eye briefly, gesturing a graceful, apologetic honesty and serious import.
But there are bad things in the world, old things in the shape of men, and there are a handful worse than all the rest. They walk the world freely and do terrible things.
I felt hope rising within me.
I have also heard them called the Chandrian, I said.
Shayan nodded.
I have heard this too, but Rinta is a better word.
Shayan gave me a long look and fell back into Ademic.
Given what Tempi has told me of your reaction, I think that you have met such a one before.
Yes.
Will you meet such a one again?
Yes. The certainty in my own voice surprised me.
With purpose?
Yes.
What purpose?
To kill him.
Such things are not easily killed.
I nodded.
Will you use what Tempi has taught you to do this?
I will use all things to that purpose. I unconsciously began to gesture absolute, but the bandage on my hand stopped me. I frowned at it.
That is good, Shayan said. Your Catan will not be enough. It is poor for one as old as you are. Good for a barbarian. Good for one with as little training as you have had, but still poor overall.
I fought hard to keep the eagerness out of my voice, wishing I could use my hand to indicate how important the question was to me.
Shayan, I have a great desire to know more of these Rinta.
Shayan was quiet for a long moment.
I will consider this,
she said at last, making a gesture I thought might be trepidation.
Such things are not spoken of lightly.
I kept my face impassive and forced my bandaged hand to say profound respectful desire. I thank you for considering it, Shayan. Anything you could tell me of them, I would value more than a weight of gold. Bashet gestured, firm discomfort, then polite desire, difference. 2 span ago, I couldn't have understood, but now I realized she wanted to move the conversation onto a different subject. So I bit my tongue and let it go. I knew enough about the Adem by this point to realize that pushing the issue was the worst thing to do if I wanted to learn more. In the Commonwealth, I could have pressed the point, teased and wheedled it out of the person I was talking to. That wouldn't work here. Stillness and silence were the only things that would work. I had to be patient and let Shayan return to the subject in her own time.
I was saying, Shayan continued, reluctant confession, your Catan is poor, but were you to train yourself in proper fashion for a year, you would be Tempi's equal.
You flatter me.
I do not. I tell you your weakness. You learn quickly. That leads to rash behavior, and rashness is not of the Lethani. Vashet is not alone in thinking there is something troubling about your spirit.
Shayan gave me a long look. For over a minute she stared at me. Then she gave an eloquent shrug and glanced at Vashet, favoring the younger woman with a ghost of a smile.
Still, whimsical musing, if I have ever met someone without a single shadow on their heart, it was surely a child too young for speaking.
She pushed herself out of her chair and brushed off her shirt with both hands.
Come, let us go and have a name for you.
Shayan led the three of us up the side of a steep, rocky hill. None of us had spoken since we had left the school. I didn't know what was about to happen, but it didn't seem proper to ask. It would have seemed irreverent, like a groom blurting out, "What comes next?" halfway through his own wedding. We came to a grassy ledge with a leaning tree clutching tight to the bare face of a cliff. Beside the tree was a thick wooden door, one of the hidden Adam homes. Cheyenne knocked and opened the door herself. Inside, it wasn't cave-like at all. The stone walls were finished, and the floor was smooth wood. It was much larger than I'd expected, too, with a high ceiling and six doors leading deeper into the stone of the cliff. A woman sat at a low table, copying something from one book into another. Her hair was white, her face wrinkled as an old apple. It occurred to me, then, that this was the first person I'd seen reading or writing in all my time in Hert. The old woman nodded a greeting at Cheyenne, then turned to Vachette, and her eyes crinkled around the edges. Gladness.
"Vachette," she said. "I did not know you were returned."
"We are come for a name, Magwin," Cheyenne said, polite, formal entreaty.
"A name?" Magwin asked, puzzled.
She looked from Cheyenne to Vachette, then her eyes moved to where I stood behind them, to my bright red hair and my bandaged hand.
"Ah,"
she said, growing suddenly somber. Magwin closed her books and came to her feet. Her back was bent, and she took small, shuffling steps. She motioned me forward and walked a slow circle around me, looking me carefully up and down. She avoided looking at my face, but took hold of my unbandaged hand, turning it over to look at the palm and the fingertips.
"I would hear you say something," she said, still looking intently at my hand.
"As you will, honored shaper of names," I said. Magwin looked up at Cheyenne.
"Does he mock me?"
"I think not."
Magwin made another circle of me, running her hands over my shoulders, my arms, the back of my neck. She moved her fingers through my hair, then stopped in front of me and looked me fully in the eye. Her eyes were like Elodin's. Not in any of the details. Elodin's eyes were green, sharp, and mocking. Magwin's were the familiar Adam gray, slightly watery and red around the edges. No. The similarity was in how she looked at me. Elodin was the only other person I had met who could look at you like that, as if you were a book he was idly thumbing through. When Magwin met my eyes for the first time, I felt like all the air had been sucked out of me. For the barest of moments, I thought she might be startled by what she saw, but that was probably just my anxiety. I had come to the edge of disaster too often lately, and despite how well my recent test had gone, part of me was still waiting for the other shoe to drop.
"Maedra,"
she said, her eyes still fixed on mine. She looked down and made her way back to her book.
"Maedra," Vachette said, a hint of dismay in her voice.
She might have said more, but Cheyenne reached out and cuffed her sharply on the side of the head. It was exactly the same motion Vachette had used to chastise me 1,000 times in the last month. I couldn't help myself. I laughed. Vachette and Cheyenne glared at me. Actually glared. Magwin turned to look at me. She didn't seem upset.
"Do you laugh at the name I have given you?"
"Never, Magwin," I said, trying my best to gesture respect with my bandaged hand. "Names are important things." She continued to eye me.
"And what would a barbarian know of names?"
"Some," I said, fumbling with my bandaged hand again. I couldn't add fine shades of meaning to my words without it. "Far away, I have made a study of such things. I know more than many, but still only just a little." Magwin looked at me for a long time.
"Then you will know you should not speak of your new name to anyone," she said. "It is a private thing, and dangerous to share."
I nodded. Magwin looked satisfied at this and settled back onto her chair, opening a book.
"Vachette, my little rabbit, you should come and visit me soon."
Gentle chiding fondness.
I will, Grandmother, Vachette said.
Thank you, Magwin,
Cheyenne said, deferential gratitude. The old woman nodded a distracted dismissal, and Cheyenne led us from the cave. Later that evening, I walked back to Vachette's house. She was sitting on the bench out front, watching the sky as the sun began to set. She tapped the bench beside her, and I took a seat.
How does it feel to no longer be a barbarian? She asked.
Mostly the same, I said. Slightly drunker. After dinner, Pentha had pulled me away to her house, where there was a party of sorts. Call it a gathering, rather, as there was no music or dancing. Still, I was flattered that Pentha had gone to the effort of finding 5 other Adem who were willing to celebrate my admittance to the school. I was pleased to learn the Adem impassivity dissolved quite easily after a few drinks, and we were all grinning like barbarians in no time. It relaxed me, especially as much of my own clumsiness with the language could now be blamed on my bandaged hand.
Earlier today, I said carefully, Cheyenne said she knew a story about the Rinta.
Vachette turned to look at me, her face expressionless, hesitant.
I have searched all over the world for such a thing, I said. There are few things I would value more.
Utter sincerity.
And I worry that I did a poor job of letting Cheyenne know this.
Questioning. Intense entreaty. Vachette looked at me for a moment, as if waiting for me to continue. Then she gestured reluctance.
I will mention it to her, she said.
Reassurance. Finished. I nodded and let the subject drop. Vachette and I sat for a while in companionable silence as the sun slowly sank into the horizon. She drew a deep breath and sighed expansively. I realized that, with the exception of waiting for me to catch my breath or recover from a fall, we had never done anything like this before. Up until this point, every moment we had spent together had been focused on my training.
Tonight, I said at last, Pentha told me she thought I had a fine anger, and that she'd like to share it with me.
Vachette chuckled.
That didn't take very long.
She gave me a knowing look.
What happened?
I blushed a bit.
She reminded me the Adem do not consider physical contact particularly intimate.
Vachette's smile grew practically lecherous.
Grabbed hold of you, did she?
Almost, I said. I move more quickly than I did a month ago.
I doubt you move quickly enough to keep away from Pentha, Vachette said. All she is looking for is sex play. There is no harm in it.
That is why I was asking you, I said slowly, to see if there was any harm in it. Vachette raised an eyebrow, at the same time gesturing vague puzzlement.
Pentha is quite lovely, I said carefully. However, you and I have...
I looked for an appropriate term.
Been intimate.
Realization washed over Vachette's face, and she laughed again.
What you mean is that we have been sexual. The intimacy between a teacher and student is greater by far than that.
Ah, I said, relaxing.
I'd suspected something of the sort, but it's nice to know for certain. Vachette shook her head.
I had forgotten what it is like with you barbarians, she said, her voice heavy with fond indulgence. It has been so many years since I had to explain such things to my poet king.
So you would not be offended if I were to...
I made an inarticulate gesture with my bandaged hand.
You are young and energetic, she said. It is a healthy thing for you to do. Why would I be offended? Do I suddenly own your sex? That I should be worried about you giving it away?
Vachette stopped, as if something had just occurred to her. She turned to look at me.
Are you offended that I have been having sex with others all this while?
She watched my face intently.
I see you are startled by it.
I am startled, I admitted.
Then I did a mental inventory and was surprised to discover I wasn't sure how I felt. "I feel I ought to be offended," I said at last, "but I don't think I am." Dachette nodded approvingly.
"That is a good sign. It shows you are becoming civilized. The other feeling is what you were brought up to think. It is like an old shirt that no longer fits you, and now, when you look at it closely, you can see it was ugly to begin with."
I hesitated for a moment.
"Out of curiosity," I said, "how many others have you been with since we have been together?"
Vachette seemed surprised by the question. She pursed her mouth and looked up at the sky for a long moment before shrugging.
"How many people have I spoken with since then? How many have I sparred with? How many times have I eaten or practiced my katan? Who counts such things?"
"And most Adem think this way?" I asked, glad to finally have the chance to ask these questions. "That sex is not an intimate thing?"
"Of course it is intimate," Vachette said. "Anything that brings two people close together is intimate. A conversation, a kiss, a whisper. Even fighting is intimate. But we are not strange about our sex. We do not feel shame about it. We do not feel it important to keep someone else's sex all to ourselves, like a miser hoarding gold."
She shook her head.
"More than any other, this strangeness in your thinking sets you barbarians apart."
"But what of romance, then?" I asked, slightly indignant. "What of love?"
Vachette laughed again then, loud and long and vastly amused. Half of Hert must have heard it, and it echoed back to us from the distant hills.
"You barbarians," she said, wiping moisture from her eyes. "I had forgotten how backward you are. My poet king was the same way. It took him a long, miserable time before he realized the truth of things. There is a great deal of difference between a penis and a heart."
Chapter 125, Sasura. The next day I woke somewhat blearily. I hadn't drunk that much, but my body was no longer used to such things. And so I felt each drink three times that morning. I straggled to the baths, dunked myself in the hottest pool I could stand, then scrubbed the vaguely gritty feeling away as best I could. I was heading back to the dining hall when Vachette and Cheyenne found me in the hallway. Vachette gestured for me to follow, and I fell in step behind them. I hardly felt up for training or a formal conversation, but refusing didn't seem like a realistic option. We wound our way through several hallways, eventually emerging near the center of the school. Passing through a courtyard, we approached a small, square building that Cheyenne unlocked with a small iron key, the first locked door I had seen in all of Hert. The three of us moved into a small, windowless entryway. Vachette closed the outside door, and the room grew black as pitch, cutting off the sound of the persistent wind. Then Cheyenne opened the inner door. Warm light from a half-dozen candles greeted us. At first, it seemed odd they had been left to burn in an empty room. Then I saw what hung on the walls. Swords gleamed in the candlelight, dozens of them covering the walls. They were all of them naked, their scabbards hanging underneath them. There were no ritual trappings of the sort you might find in a Talon church, no tapestries or paintings, just the swords themselves. Still, it was obvious that this was an important place. There was a tension in the air of the sort you might feel in the archives or an old graveyard. Cheyenne turned to Vachette. "Choose." Vachette looked startled by this, almost stricken. She started to make a gesture, but Cheyenne held up a hand before she could protest.
"He is your student," Cheyenne said.
"Refusal.
You have brought him into the school. It is your choice."
Vachette looked from Cheyenne to me, to the dozens of gleaming swords. They were all slender and deadly, each subtly different from the others. Some were curved, some longer or thicker than others. Some showed signs of much use, while some few resembled Vachette's, with worn hilts and unmarked blades of gray burnished metal. Slowly, Vachette moved to the right-hand wall. She picked up a sword, hefted it, and put it back. Then she lifted a different one, gripped it, and held it out to me. I took hold of it. It was light and thin as a whisper. "Maiden combs her hair," Vachette said. I obeyed, feeling somewhat self-conscious as Cheyenne was watching. But before I made it halfway through the sweeping movement, Vachette was already shaking her head. She took the sword back from me and returned it to the wall. After another minute, she handed me a second sword. It had worn etching running down the blade like a crawling ivy. At Vachette's request, I made Heron Falling. I swept high and lunged low, sword flickering. Vachette raised an eyebrow to me, questioning. I shook my head. "The point is too heavy for me." Vachette didn't seem particularly surprised and returned that sword to the wall as well. So things continued. Vachette hefted swords and rejected most without a word. She set three more in my hands, asked for various pieces of the katan, then returned them to the wall without asking my opinion. Vachette moved more slowly as she made her way along the second wall. She handed me a sword slightly curved like Penta's, and my breath caught when I saw the blade was the same flawless burnished gray as Vachette's. I took it carefully, but the grip wasn't right for my fingers. When I handed it back, I saw relief written plainly on her face. As she progressed along the wall, occasionally Vachette would steal a glance at Cheyenne. At those moments, she looked very little like my confident, swaggering teacher, and very much like a young woman desperately hoping for a word of advice. Cheyenne remained impassive. Eventually, Vachette came to the third wall, moving slower and slower. She handled almost every sword now, taking a long time before setting them back in their places. Then slowly, she laid her hand on another sword with a blade of burnished gray. She lifted it off the wall, gripped it, and seemed to age 10 years. Vachette avoided looking at Cheyenne and handed me the sword. The guard of this one extended out slightly, curving to give a hint of protection to the hand. It was nothing like a full hand guard. Anything that bulky would render half the katan useless, but it looked as if it would give my fingers an extra bit of shelter, and that was appealing to me. The warm grip settled into my palm as smoothly as the neck of my lute. Before she could ask, I made Maiden combs her hair. It felt like stretching after a long, stiff sleep. I eased into 12 stones, and for the smallest of moments, I felt graceful as Pentha looked when she fought. I made Heron Falling, and it was sweet and simple as a kiss. Vachette held out her hand to take it back from me. I didn't want to give it up, but I did. I knew this was the worst possible time and place for me to make a scene. Holding the sword, Vachette turned to Cheyenne. "This is the one for him," she said. And for the first time since I'd known my teacher, it was as if all the laughing had been pressed out of her. Her voice was thin and dry. Cheyenne nodded. "I agree. You have done well to find it." Vachette's relief was palpable, though her face still looked somewhat stricken. "It will perhaps offset his name," she said. She held the sword out to Cheyenne. Cheyenne gestured. Refusal. "No. Your student. Your choice. Your responsibility." Vachette took the scabbard from the wall and sheathed the sword. Then she turned and held it out to me. "This is named Sesra." "Sesra?" I asked, startled by the name. Wasn't that what Sim had called the break in the line of Eldvintic verse? Was I being given a poet's sword? "Sesra," she said softly, as if it were the name of God. She stepped back, and I felt the weight of it settle back into my hands. Sensing something was expected of me, I drew it from its sheath. The faint ring of leather and metal seemed a whisper of its name. Sesra. It felt light in my hand. The blade was flawless. I slid it back into its sheath, and the sound was different. It sounded like the breaking of a line. It said, Sasura. Cheyenne opened the inner door, and we left as we came, silently and with respect. The rest of the day was quite the opposite of exciting. With a dogged and humorless persistence, Bachet taught me how to care for my sword, how to clean and oil my sword, how to dismantle and reassemble my sword, how to strap the scabbard to my shoulder or hip, how the slightly enlarged guard would alter a few of the grips and motions of the K-10. The sword was not mine. The sword belonged to the school, to Ademre. I would return it when I was no longer able to fight. While I normally have little tolerance for hearing the same thing over and over again, I let Vachette ramble. The least I could do was let her repeat herself a bit when she was plainly anxious and trying to settle her mind. Around the 15th repetition, I asked what I should do if the sword broke. Not the hilt or the guard, but the blade itself. Should I still bring it back? Vachette gave me a look of dismay so raw it verged on horror. She didn't answer, and I made a point of not asking any more questions for the rest of the morning. After lunch, Vachette took me back to Magwin's cave. My teacher's mood seemed somewhat improved, but she was still far from her regular gregarious self. "Magwin will be giving you Sesra's story," she said. "You must memorize it." "Its story?" I asked. Vachette shrugged. "In Ademic it is Atas. It is the history of your sword, everyone who has carried it, what they have done. It is something you must know." We reached the top of the path and stood before Magwin's door. Vachette gave me a serious look. "You must be on your best behavior and be very polite." "I will," I said. "Magwin is an important person, and you must attend closely to what she says." "I will," I said. Vachette knocked on the door and escorted me in. Magwin sat at the same table as before. For all I could tell, she was copying the same book. She smiled when she saw Vachette, then noticed me, and let her face slide into the familiar Adem impassivity. "Magwin," Vachette said, profoundly polite entreaty. "This one needs the Atas of his sword."
"Which sword did you find for him?" Magwin asked, her face wrinkling even further as she squinted to see it.
"Sesra," Vachette said.
Magwin gave a laugh that was almost a cackle. She got down off her chair.
"I can't say I'm surprised," she said, and disappeared through a door that led back into the cliff.
Vachette let herself out, and I stood there feeling awkward, like one of those terrible dreams when you're on stage and can't remember what to say, or even what part you were meaning to play. Magwin returned, carrying a thick book bound in brown leather. At a gesture from her, we took seats in chairs facing each other. Hers was a deeply cushioned leather chair. Mine was not. I sat with Sasura across my knees, partly because it seemed appropriate, and partly because I was fond of the feel of it beneath my hand. She opened the book, the binding crackling as she spread it open on her lap. She flipped pages for a moment until she found the place she was looking for.
"First came Chael," she read, "who shaped me in fire for an unknown purpose. He carried me, then cast me aside."
Magwin looked up, unable to gesture as her hands were both occupied by the large book.
"Well?" she demanded.
"What would you like me to do?" I asked politely. I couldn't gesture due to my bandages. We made a fine pair of half-mutes.
"Repeat it back," she said, irritated. "You need to learn them all."
"First came Chael," I said, "who shaped me in fire for an unknown purpose. He carried me, then cast me aside." She nodded and continued.
"Next came Etain."
I repeated it. We continued this way for perhaps a half hour, owner after owner, name after name, loyalties declaimed and enemies killed. At first, the names and places were tantalizing. Then, as it continued, the list began to depress me, as nearly each piece ended with the death of the owner, They were not peaceful deaths either. Some died in wars, some in duels. Many were merely killed by or slain by, giving no clue as to the circumstances. After 30 of these, I had heard nothing resembling passed from this world peacefully in his sleep, surrounded by fat grandchildren. Then, the list stopped being depressing and became simply boring instead. "Next came Finol of the clear and shining eye," I repeated attentively. "Much beloved of Dulcin. She herself slew two Daruna, then was killed by Gremin at the Drossen Tor." I cleared my throat before Magwin could recite another passage. "If I may ask," I said, "how many have carried Sasura over the years?"
"Sasra," she corrected me sharply. "Do not presume to meddle with her name. It means to break, to catch, and to fly."
I looked down at the sheathed sword across my lap. I felt the weight of it, the chill of the metal under my fingers. A small sliver of the smooth gray blade was visible above the top of the sheath. "How can I say this so you can understand? Sasra was a fine name. It was thin and bright and dangerous. It fit the sword like a glove fits a hand. But it wasn't the perfect name. This sword's name was Sasura. This sword was the jarring break in a line of perfect verse. It was the broken breath. It was smooth and swift and sharp and deadly. The name didn't fit it like a glove. It fit like skin. More than that, it was bone and muscle and movement. Those things are the hand. And Sasura was the sword. It was both the name and the thing itself. I can't tell you how I knew this, but I knew it. Besides, if I was to be a namer, I decided I could damn well choose the name of my own sword." I looked up at Magwin. "It is a good name," I agreed politely, deciding to keep my opinion to myself until I was well gone from Ademre. "I am only wondering how many owners there have been entirely. That is something I should know as well." Magwin gave me a sour look that said she knew I was patronizing her, but she flipped ahead several pages in her book. Then a few more. Then a few more.
236, she said. "You will be the 237th.
She flipped back to the beginning of the list.
"Let us begin again."
She drew a breath and said,
"First came Chael, who shaped me in fire for an unknown purpose. He carried me, then cast me aside."
I fought down the urge to sigh. Even with my trooper's knack for learning lines, it would take long, weary days setting them all to memory. Then I realized what this truly meant. If each owner had kept Sasura for 10 years, and it had never sat idle for longer than a day or two, that meant Sasura was, at a very conservative estimate, more than 2,000 years old. I received my next surprise 3 hours later when I tried to excuse myself for supper. As I stood to leave, Magwin explained I was to remain with her until I learned all of Sasura's story by heart. Someone would bring us our meals, and there was a room nearby where I could sleep. First came Chael. Chapter 126, The First Stone. I spent the next 3 days with Magwin. It wasn't bad, especially considering my left hand was still healing, so my ability to talk and fight was rather limited. I like to think I did rather well. It would have been easier for me to memorize an entire play than this. A play fits together like a jigsaw. Dialogue moves back and forth. There is a shape to a story. But what I learned from Magwin was merely a long string of unfamiliar names and unconnected events. It was a laundry list masquerading as a story. Still, I learned it all by heart. It was late in the evening of the third day when I recited it back flawlessly to Magwin. The hardest part was not singing it as I recited. Music carries words over miles and into hearts and memories. Committing Sasura's history to memory had been much easier when I'd started fitting it to the tune of an old vintage ballad in my head. The next morning, Magwin demanded I recite it again. After I made it through a second time, she scribbled a note to Cheyenne, sealed it in wax, and shooed me out of her cave.
"We had not expected Magwin to be finished with you for several days yet," Cheyenne said, reading the note. "Vachette took a trip to Faint, and will not be back for at least 2 days."
That meant I had memorized the A-Tas twice as quickly as their best estimate. I felt more than a little pride in that. Shane glanced at my left hand and gave the barest frown.
"When did you have your dressings removed?" she asked.
"I could not find you at first," I said. "So I went to visit Dalen. He said it was healed quite nicely." I flexed my newly unbandaged left hand and gestured joyful relief. "There is hardly any stiffness in the skin, and he reassures me even that will fade soon with proper care." I looked at Cheyenne, expecting to see some gesture of approval or satisfaction. Instead, I saw exasperated irritation. "Have I done something wrong?" I asked, confused regret, apology. Cheyenne motioned to my hand.
"It could have been a convenient excuse to postpone your stone trial," she said, irritated resignation. "Now we must go ahead with it today, Vachette or no."
I felt a familiar anxiety settle back onto me, like a dark bird clenching its claws deep into the muscles of my neck and shoulders. I'd thought the tedium of memorization had been the last of it, but apparently the final shoe was yet to drop. I didn't like the sound of the term stone trial either.
"Return here after midday meal," Cheyenne said. Dismissal.
"Go.
I have much to prepare before then."
I went looking for Pentha. With Vachette gone, she was the only one I knew well enough to ask about the upcoming trial. But she wasn't in her house, the school, or the baths. Eventually, I gave up, stretched, and rehearsed my K-10, first with Sasura, then without. Then I made my way to the baths and scrubbed away 3 days of sitting and doing nothing. Cheyenne was waiting for me when I returned after lunch, holding her carved wooden sword. She looked at my empty hands and made an exasperated gesture.
"Where is your dueling sword?"
"In my room," I said. "I did not know I would need it."
"Run, fetch it," she said. "Then meet me at the stone hill."
"Cheyenne," I said, urgent, imploring. "I don't know where that is. I don't know anything about the stone trial." Surprised.
"Vachette never told you?"
Disbelief. I shook my head. Sincere apology. "We were focused on other things." Exasperation.
"It is simple enough," she said. "First, you will recite Sesra's A-Tas for all gathered. Then you will climb the hill. At the first stone, you will fight one from the school who is ranked of the first stone. If you win, you will continue to climb and fight someone of the second stone."
Cheyenne looked at me.
"In your case, this is a formality. Occasionally, a student enters the school with exceptional talent. Vachette was one such as this, and she gained the second stone at her first trial."
Blunt honesty.
"You are not such a one. Your K-10 is still poor, and you cannot expect to gain even the first stone. The stone hill is east of the baths."
She flicked her hand at me. "Hurry." There was a crowd gathered at the foot of the stone hill by the time I arrived. More than 100 people. Gray homespun and muted colors vastly outnumbered mercenary red, and the low murmur of the crowd's conversation was audible from a distance. The hill itself wasn't particularly high, nor was it steep, but the path to the top cut back and forth in a series of switchbacks. At each corner, there was a wide, flat space with a large block of gray stone. There were 4 corners, 4 stones, and 4 red-shirted mercenaries. At the top of the hill stood a tall gray stone, familiar as a friend. Beside that stood a small figure in blinding white. As I came closer, I caught a smell drifting on the breeze, toasted chestnuts. Only then did I relax. This was pageantry of a sort. While Stone Trial had an intimidating sound to it, I doubted very much that I was going to be brutalized in front of a milling audience while someone sold roasted nuts. I entered the crowd and approached the hill. I could see it was Cheyenne next to the gray stone. I also recognized the heart-shaped face and long, hanging braid of Pentha at the third stone. The crowd parted gently as I walked to the foot of the hill. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a blood-red figure rushing toward me. Alarmed, I turned and saw it was none other than Tempe. He hurried toward me, gesturing a broad, enthusiastic greeting. I fought the urge to smile and shout his name, settling instead on a gesture of joyful excitement. He came to stand directly in front of me, gripping me by my shoulder and jostling me around playfully, as if congratulating me. But his eyes were intense. Close to his chest, his hand said, "Deception," where only I could see.
"Listen."
He spoke quickly under his breath.
"You cannot win this fight."
"Don't worry," reassurance. "Cheyenne thinks the same, but I might surprise you." Tempe's grip on my shoulder grew painfully tight.
"Listen,"
he hissed.
"Look who is at the first stone."
I looked over his shoulder. It was Carceret. Her eyes were like knives.
"She is full of rage,"
Tempe said quietly, gesturing fond affection for the crowd to see.
"As if your admittance to the school was not enough, you have been given her mother's sword."
That piece of news knocked the wind out of me. My mind flickered to the final piece of the ATAS. "Laurel was Carceret's mother?" I asked. Tempe ran his right hand affectionately through my hair.
"Yes, she is enraged past reason. I fear she would gladly cripple you, even if it means being thrown from the school."
I nodded seriously.
"She will try to disarm you. Be wary of it. Do not grapple. If she catches you with sleeping bear or circling hands, submit quickly. Shout it if you must. If you hesitate or try to break away, she will shatter your arm or pull it from your shoulder. I heard her say this to her sister not an hour ago."
Suddenly, Tempe stepped away from me and gestured deferential respect. I felt a tapping at my arm and turned to see Magwin's wrinkled face.
"Come," she said with quiet authority. "It is time."
I fell into step behind her. As we walked, everyone in the crowd gestured some manner of respect toward her. Magwin led me to the beginning of the path. There was a block of gray stone, slightly taller than my knee and identical to the others at each corner of the path. The old woman gestured for me to climb up onto the stone. I looked out over the group of Adem and had an unprecedented moment of stage fright. Bending a bit, I spoke softly to Magwin.
"Is it appropriate for me to raise my voice when reciting this?"
I asked her nervously. "I do not mean to be offensive, but if I do not, those in the back will not be able to hear." Magwin smiled at me for the first time, her wrinkled face suddenly sweet. She patted my hand.
"No one will be offended at a loud voice here," she said, gesturing considerate moderation. "Give."
I unbuckled Sesra and handed it over. Then Magwin urged me onto the stone. I recited the ATAS while Magwin watched. Though I was confident of my memory, it was still nerve-wracking. I wondered what would happen if I skipped an owner or misplaced a name. It took the better part of an hour before I was done, the audience of Adem listening with an almost eerie quiet. When I finished, Magwin offered her hand, helping me down from the stone as if I were a lady descending from a carriage. Then she gestured up the hill. I wiped the sweat from my hand and gripped the wooden hilt of my dueling sword as I started up the path. Carceret's reds were strapped tightly across her long arms and broad shoulders. The leather straps she used were wider and thicker than Tempe's. They looked to be a brighter red, too, and I wonder if she had dyed them especially for today. As I came closer, I saw she had the fading remains of a black eye. Once she saw I was watching, Carceret tossed her wooden sword away in a slow, deliberate motion. She gestured disdain broadly enough so they could see it in the halfpenny seats at the back of the crowd. There was a murmur from the crowd as I stopped walking, uncertain what to do. After a moment's thought, I lay my own training sword down by the side of the path and continued to walk. Carceret waited in the center of a flat, grassy circle, about 30 feet across. The ground was soft here, so I wouldn't ordinarily worry about being thrown. Ordinarily. Vachette had taught me the difference between throwing someone to the ground and throwing someone at the ground. The first was what you did during a polite bout. The second was what you would use in a true fight where the intention was to maim or kill your opponent. Before I came too close, I fell into the now familiar fighter's crouch. I raised my hands, bent my knees, and fought the urge to raise up onto the balls of my feet, knowing I would feel quicker and ruin my balance as a result. I took a deep, steadying breath and slowly moved toward her. Carceret fell into a similar crouch, and just as I was coming to the outside limits of her reach, she made a feint toward me. It was only a slight twitch of the hand and shoulder, but anxious as I was, I fell for it wholeheartedly and skittered away like a startled rabbit. Carceret lowered her hands and stood up straight, abandoning her fighting crouch. Amusement, she gestured broadly. Invitation. Then she beckoned with both hands. I heard a few pieces of laughter drift up from the crowd below. Humiliating as her attitude was, I was eager to take advantage of her lowered guard. I moved forward and made a cautious attempt at hands like knives. Too cautious, and she stepped away from it without even needing to lift her hands. I knew I was outclassed as a fighter. That meant my only hope was to play on her already hot emotions. If I could infuriate her, she might make mistakes. If she made mistakes, I might be able to win. First came Chael, I said, giving her my widest, most barbaric smile. Carceret took a half step closer.
I am going to crush your pretty hands, she hissed in perfect Aetorian.
As she spoke, she reached out and made a vicious gripping motion at me. She was trying to scare me, make me recoil and lose my balance, and honestly, the raw venom in her voice made me want to do just that. But I was ready. I resisted my reflex to pull back. In doing so, I froze for a moment, neither retreating nor advancing. Of course, this is what Carceret was truly waiting for. A half moment's hesitation as I fought the urge to flee. She closed on me in a single easy step and caught my wrist, her hand tight as a band of iron. Without thinking, I used Celian's curious two-handed version of Break Lion. Perfect for a small girl struggling against a grown man, or a hopelessly outclassed musician trying to escape an Adam mercenary. I regained control of my hand, and the unorthodox movement startled Carceret ever so slightly. I took advantage of it and struck out quickly with sowing barley, snapping my knuckles hard against the meat of her inner bicep. It wasn't a hard punch. I was too close for that. But if I managed to hit the nerve properly, the blow would numb her hand. This wouldn't just make her weak on her left side, but it would make all the two-handed motions of the Catan more difficult. A significant advantage. Since I was still so close, I immediately followed sowing barley with turn millstone, giving her a short, firm push to knock her off balance. I managed to get both hands on her, and even pushed her backward by perhaps 4 inches. But Carceret came nowhere near to losing her balance. Then I saw her eyes. I'd thought she'd been angry before, but it was nothing compared to now. Now, I'd managed to actually strike her. Not just once, but twice. A barbarian with less than 2 months of training had struck her twice, while everyone in the school looked on. I cannot describe how she looked, and even if I could, it would not impress upon you the truth of things, as her face was still almost entirely impassive. Instead, let me say this. I have never seen anyone so furious in my entire life. Not Ambrose, not Hem, not Denna when I criticized her song, or the mayor when I defied him. Those angers were pale candles compared to the forge fire burning in Carceret's eyes. But even in the full flower of her fury, Carceret was perfectly in control. She didn't lash out wildly or snarl at me.
She kept her words inside her, burning them like fuel. I couldn't win this fight, but my hands moved automatically, trained by hundreds of hours of practice to take advantage of her nearness. I stepped forward and tried to grab hold of her for thunder upward. Her hands snapped out, brushing the attack away. Then she lashed out with Bargeman at the dock. I don't think she expected it to connect. A more competent opponent would have avoided or blocked it. But I had let myself get slightly wrong-footed, so I was off balance. So I was slow. So her foot caught me in the stomach and pushed. Bargeman at the dock isn't a quick kick meant to break bones. It is a kick that shoves the opponent off balance. As I was already off balance, it pushed me right off my feet. I landed jarringly on my back, then rolled to stop in a messy tangle of limbs. Now, some might say that I had taken a bad fall and was obviously too stupefied to find my feet and continue the fight. Others might say that while it was messy, the fall wasn't quite as hard as all that, and I had certainly found my feet after worse. Personally, I think the line between being stupefied and being wise is sometimes very thin. How thin, I suppose, I will leave you to decide. Chapter 127. Anger.
What were you thinking?
Tempi demanded. Disappointment. Fierce chastisement.
What fool sets his sword aside?
She threw her sword away first, I protested.
Only to lure you in, Tempi said. Only as a trap.
I was buckling Sasura's scabbard so the hilt hung over my shoulder. There hadn't been any particular ceremony after I had lost. Magwin simply returned my sword and smiled at me, patting my hand in a comforting way. I watched the crowd slowly dispersing below and gestured polite disbelief to Tempi.
Should I have kept my sword when she was unarmed?
Yes.
Absolute agreement.
She is 5 times the fighter you are. You might have had a chance if you had kept your sword.
Tempi is right, I heard Shan's voice behind me. Knowing your enemy is in keeping with the Lathani. Once a fight is inevitable, a clever fighter takes any advantage.
I turned and saw her coming down the path. Pentha walked beside her. I gestured, polite certainty. If I had kept my sword and won, people would have thought Carceret was a fool and resented me for gaining a rank I did not deserve. And if I had kept my sword and lost, it would have been humiliating. Neither reflects well on me. I looked back and forth between Shane and Tempi. Am I wrong in this?
You are not wrong in this, Shane said. But neither is Tempi wrong.
Victory is always to be sought,
Tempi said, firm. Shane turned to face him.
Success is key, she said. Victory is not always needed to succeed.
Tempi gestured, respectful disagreement, and opened his mouth to respond, but Pentha spoke first, cutting him off.
Quoth, are you hurt from your fall?
Not badly, I said, moving my back gingerly. A few bruises, perhaps.
Do you have anything to put on them?
I shook my head. Pentha stepped forward and took hold of my arm.
I have things at my house. We will leave these two to discuss the Lathani. Someone should tend to your hurts.
She held my arm with her left hand, making her statement curiously empty of any emotional content.
Of course, Shane said after a moment, and Tempi gestured a hasty agreement.
But Pentha was already leading me firmly down the hill. We walked for a quarter mile or so, Pentha holding my arm lightly. Eventually, she spoke in her lightly accented Aeturin.
Are you bruised badly enough to need a salve?
She asked. Not really, I admitted.
I thought not, she said. But after I have lost a fight, I rarely wish to have people tell me how I lost it.
She flashed me a small, secret smile. I smiled back. We continued to walk, and Pentha kept hold of my arm, subtly guiding us through a grove of trees, then up a steep path carved through a small bluff.
Eventually, we came to a secluded dell that had a carpet of wild papaver flower blossoming among the grass. Their loose, blood-red petals were almost exactly the same color as Pentha's mercenary reds.
Veshet told